Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shameful and craven fealty on display today in Helsinki at the press conference which followed Trump's meeting with Putin, in which our president blamed America and sided with the leader of a hostile foreign power who intervened in our elections and, according to our Director of National Intelligence, continues to attack the infrastructure and election systems of the United States to this day. David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs and author of The Great Questions of Tomorrow, joins us to discuss his article at The Daily Beast, "Way Trump Deals with Russian Attacks is Textbook Treason." We will assess whether today's disgraceful display of a weak and compromised president kowtowing to a ruthless despot could be a turning point for the American people to recognize that the Republicans who are seeking to undermine the Mueller investigation are serving Russian interests as much as the indicted Russian military officers who attacked us were. And with Senate Minority Leader Schumer speculating that Putin, quote, holds damaging information over Trump, we will look into what it will take for Republican enablers of their traitor-in-chief to rediscover their patriotism. Then we'll go to Prague and speak with an expert on transnational crime and Russian security affairs, Mark Galeotti, a senior researcher at the Institute for International Relations in Prague, whose latest book is The Vory, Russia's Super Mafia. He joins us to discuss how much Trump was outmatched by Putin, who appeared as more than an equal on the world stage after coming off a very successful World Cup Russia hosted, and the alarm felt amongst America's European allies as Trump praises Putin while calling the EU a foe. Then finally, we will speak with Russian expert Catherine Stoner, Director of International Policy Studies and a Senior Fellow at Stanford University Center for Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. The author of the forthcoming book, Russia's Return as a Global Power, she joins us to discuss how disheartening it is to see our own president reject the findings of our own Justice Department and intelligence agencies to defend Putin and blame everything on Hillary Clinton and her email servers. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. A longtime contributor to Foreign Policy magazine, he was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017, and his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow, and he has an article at the Daily Beast, "Way Trump Deals with Russian Attacks is Textbook Treason." Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be here. Good to be back.
Well, thank you, David. And it does seem that the treason, the T word, is coming back. I've been using it for some time. I noticed that Charles Blow's op-ed in today's New York Times mentioned it. And the former director of Central Intelligence, John Brennan, in response to Trump's press conference today in Helsinki with Putin, said it was nothing short of treasonous. And you're describing it as textbook treason. So could this be a turning point that we're finally talking about something that might even get the Republicans into tension?
You know, it's really hard to say. The Republicans, you know, seem to be willing to overlook serial sexual abuse, allegations of rape, corruption, ethical violations by Trump, ethical violations by his family, ethical violations by a goodly chunk of his cabinet, insults to our allies, undermining our alliances, breaking our word, and frankly, they've been willing to overlook the growing weight of the evidence that Trump was the preferred candidate of the Russian government, that the Russian government undertook a major campaign to try to help tip the scales in his favor, and that whether or not they succeeded, he then actively took a role in defending them and obstructing the prosecution of their case. And as the attack is ongoing, in enabling the ongoing attack. Now, to me, that's why I end up at the word treason. You know, the Constitution in Article 3 says that treason involves adhering to an enemy or providing them aid and comfort. This is not a political issue. This is the Russian military. This is the GRU, the military intelligence unit of the Russian military. We've named officers' names. We explained what they did. And, you know, it seems very clear. This is a military attack on the United States. And whether he knew that it was going to happen at the beginning or not, he certainly has known of it, been told of it frequently, denied it, distracted from it, enabled it to continue. And that, to me, is adhering yourself to an enemy and providing aid and comfort to that enemy. But even after all of this, and even after this obsequious performance of Trump standing next to Putin, giving him everything he wanted in exchange for nothing, attacking the intelligence community, attacking their credibility versus that of a man who is a known liar who in a couple of days is going to celebrate the fourth anniversary of shooting down a commercial jet with 300 people on it after invading a country, breaking international laws, killing journalists. You know, this is who Trump wants to ally himself with, other than the intelligence community. What we've seen so far are statements of outrage. Republican leaders going, oh, this is disgraceful, or this is embarrassing, or I wish he had done more. But we don't see any change, you know, in the likely actions of the Republican Party. And so I don't know. This could go on for some time.
Well, let me just quote from your piece at The Daily Beast: why Trump deals with Russian attacks is textbook treason, in the sense that maybe there is something here in the zeitgeist, because it's just quoting you. This is an extraordinary moment. It is without equal, not only in American history, but in modern history. A hostile foreign power intervened in our election to help elect a man president who has since actively served their interests and has defended them at every turn. Trump may deny collusion, but given that the attacks continue, denying it is collusion. Distracting from it is collusion. Obstructing the investigation of it is collusion, because all these things enable it to go on. So he did make a passing reference to Dan Coats, but Dan Coats is a conservative Republican senator, and he says that the attacks are ongoing against our infrastructure and against our elections. And he's talked about a red light blinking, as was the case before the 9/11 attacks. So is that some indication? I may be grasping at straws here, but my sense was that I saw Trump actually exposed, almost like in The Wizard of Oz when they pull back the curtain.
I did too. Honestly, I think Dan Coats has shown some courage. This is a conservative Republican, retired senator from Indiana, who joined, I think, with Mueller last Friday to essentially send a message to the Russians, because they were not sure Trump was going to send it. And that message was, we're on to you. We know what you're doing. We are pretty sophisticated. We can name names, and we know this is ongoing, and it's very serious. And whether the president says it or not, we're going to say it, and we're going to pursue things. And when the president then today made statements to the effect that he didn't necessarily believe the intelligence community and that he believed Putin, and why would the Russians even do such a thing, Coates almost immediately came out with a statement saying, you know, this is, you know, what we believe, and we're sticking to it, and the president, you know, ought to be saying this. And he didn't run it by the White House. He didn't get political approval. He just put it out there, essentially saying, you know, in front of the world, boss, I'm not with you on this. And Trump backed off a little bit in a tweet, but I do think, you know, that of all the things that's happened since, that's the most striking, because it's actually a member of Team Trump calling out the president, which nobody else seems to be willing to do.
And again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy magazine. He was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017, and his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow, and he has an article at the Daily Beast, Way Trump Deals with Russian Attacks is Textbook Treason. So the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer today, the Democrat, effectively, along with Nancy Pelosi, the leaders of the Democratic Party, the opposition, which has so far been fairly invisible and without a narrative, he said today that Putin, quote, holds damaging information over President Trump. So if this continues and the Republicans continue to, along with Trump, undermine the Mueller investigation, will it become clear that they are serving Russia's interests as much as these officers of the GRU exposed in the Mueller indictment that came down on Friday?
Well, it's hard to guess where this is going to go. Of course, you know, there was an arrest made in Washington yesterday of yet another Russian who tried to infiltrate the National Rifle Association to make it a conduit of Russian power, even prior to Trump being the candidate, beginning in 2015. I think that we are likely to see many more shoes drop, frankly, whether or not it motivates Trump to change. But I think we're at an important turning point in this story, because I think essentially Mueller has been laying the predicate for his case by saying something serious happened. Something serious happened and was done by the Russians. We can prove it. They sought to influence our elections. And then you get to the "and" followed by ellipsis, which is, well, then what? And the question is, who did they work with here? How did they work with him? I think you're going to start to hear American names. And this is going to change the tenor of this, because it's not just going to be, you know, Manafort or Gates or anybody we've heard of from. You're going to start hearing names much closer to the president even than that, including potentially members of his family, Roger Stone, a longtime advisor, and so forth. And I think at that point, the problem is that it becomes existential for the Republican Party. You know, imagine we've got a couple more months of breaks like this prior to the midterm election. And imagine that the message is the Russians have been putting their thumb on the scale. There were members of the Trump team that likely knew about it and took advantage of it. And the president is in the wrong place on this. Well, that's going to have an electoral consequence.
But the assumption would be, surely, David Rothkopf, that our intelligence services have voluminous files on Trump. Because back in 1987, the KGB tried to recruit him. Whether or not they did, they wanted a replacement for Armand Hammer. And more recently, in November of 2013, he met in Moscow with a group of oligarchs, the richest Russians. And, of course, he's a wannabe billionaire, and he envied the real billionaires. And he seemed to return from that meeting with suddenly launching the Bertha conspiracy, which in effect launched his presidential career. And by the way, back in 1987, after he returned from Moscow, he announced he was running for president and took out full-page ads in support of Russian foreign policy. So my suspicion is that there's got to be, even before Mueller, a pretty hefty file on this guy.
There may be. And, you know, there people out there, including Democratic senators, said, you know, there's more, as you say, more to come. Maybe there's a tape. I have to tell you, if the infamous P tape exists of Donald Trump, there's nothing on that tape that's more disgusting or more of a threat to the United States than Trump's behavior on live television today. You know, essentially tossing his national security community, his advisors, people who have taken this position, from Mike Pompeo, his Secretary of State, who was there, to Dan Coats, under the bus, and doing it to win the favor of an autocrat who has utter disregard for human life or the rule of law and seeks the destruction of the Western alliance and the undermining of the United States. You know, I don't care, you know, what would be on the P tape. How could it be worse than that? This is essentially Trump saying, I'm throwing down with Putin. I'm lining myself with Putin over the United States national security establishment.
But just to follow on from Senator Schumer's rhetorical question, whether or not Putin holds damaging information over President Trump, it would seem that the whole, there's no other explanation for him going to Helsinki in the first place, for having this unnecessary meeting that had no agenda behind it except them sitting down in secret and private without note takers having a conversation. It was almost like he was checking in with his case officer, and the whole body language and this craven fealty that was on display today was almost as though he really is terrified that somehow Putin is going to reveal whatever it is that he holds over him. I mean, that seems to be a more logical explanation than anything else that I can think of.
Could be that this is the only club that would have him. Could be that he has an affinity for the Russians that has existed for 30 years and, you know, lots of trips and lots of financing and so forth. Could be really bad judgment. Could be a lot of things. At this point, I think those are all interesting academic questions. But I think that what is a known is the President of the United States is defending the President of the Russian Federation as he attacks the United States, as he seeks to undermine Western democracies in UK, in France, in Italy, in Germany, in Central Europe. The President of the United States has taken the side of Russia despite massive pressure not to do so, and essentially said, this is where my allegiance lies, and thrown the weight of the presidency behind this very, very bad guy who's in the midst of doing all this stuff. That, you know, to me, motive aside, that's enough to start talking about treason. That's enough, certainly, to start talking about impeachment. Take that, throw in 30-odd indictments and guilty pleas already, 200 charges in the Mueller case already, more to come. You know, the fact that people aren't, you know, that there isn't a chorus of people talking about impeachment now is a flaw in our system. Something is broken in our system. It should not have gotten as far as it's gotten. And the longer this guy stays in office, the more the United States will be damaged, perhaps irreversibly.
Well, if you look at the ledger in terms of the weight of evidence against Putin, you know, the Crimea, Ukraine, the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner, the poisoning of the Russians in Salisbury and the subsequently poisoning of innocent Britons by Novichok, the weaponization of refugees from Syria, the murdering of civilians, blowing up of hospitals, the use of poison gas, and so on. All of that is on the ledger. And when confronted, not by that laundry list of criminality, the best that Trump could say today was Hillary Clinton server. I mean, it was just so pathetic. And he went on, and he never answered the question, except he talked about Hillary's Clinton server. So I guess my question would be, surely that's not going to fly. Haven't people – he's been going on about this server now, what, since 2016?
Well, I don't think it's going to fly. I don't think it's going to fly. I mean, I ultimately think that the system is going to work. On the other hand, I thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. So, you know, I have a degree of humility about all of this. You know, I also know, by the way, that Donald Trump whether or not he's committed treason, has done something very close to it. Whether or not he's committed impeachable offenses with regard to Russia, has done something very close to it. But that if none of this had ever happened, he probably should be impeached for ethical violations. And if none of that had ever happened, he probably should be disqualified from office because of serial sex abuse. And if none of that had ever happened, he probably ought to be under very close scrutiny because of a host of policies around the world that have damaged the United States, and policies at home that also, whether it's environmental policies or policies on refugees or policies on poor people or the violations within his cabinet. You could devote a week of shows to reasons why Donald Trump should be impeached. And there's been no motion in that direction so far. So, you know, should it work? Yeah, it should work. Has it done the trick yet? No. So there's something very deep within our system that is protecting this man, and that's very troubling.
Well, just in closing, to try and be a little optimistic here, I highly recommend the Financial Times investigation into the Russia's investments in Trump properties and in Toronto in particular. It's an extremely detailed piece of investigative reporting by the Financial Times, which is a pretty solid newspaper, I would argue. It shows, I think, the pattern, the MO of how Russian KGB guys were filtered after the collapse of Russia, and then the assets of the former Soviet Union were looted and passed and laundered through Manhattan real estate, and in this case through Toronto, and the people that did it are identified by the Financial Times. And of course, once again, they all have close contacts with Putin, and particularly with Putin's bank, VEB, the very people that Jared Kushner was trying to get a back channel through. So it seems like that serves as, a pretty good model for further investigation.
Absolutely, as does the New York State Attorney General's case against the president for the abuses that took place within his not-for-profit, as does, you know, the series of stories that we've seen with regard to Trump properties in Central Asia or Trump property in Panama or money laundering that probably have, I think, $180 million that went through Trump real estate properties in cash from largely Russian sources, or the financing associated with Jared Kushner's property, or the recent allegations from the Chinese that Kushner started asking, you know, essentially for money and concessions during a meeting with the Chinese. So, you know, we've got a whole host of things that we could look at on that side if we didn't also have the minor issue of likely treason on this side.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Rothkopf.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy magazine. He was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017, and his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow, and he has an article at the Daily Beast, Way Trump Deals with Russian Attacks is Textbook Treason. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Prague to speak with an expert on transnational crime and Russian security affairs. Makes me glad that I'm a man. Oh, no one knows what goes on behind closed doors.
My baby makes me smile.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Prague is Mark Galeotti, who is a senior researcher at the Institute for International Relations in Prague, an expert and prolific author on transnational crime and Russian security affairs. He's also advised the British Foreign Office and many government and law enforcement agencies in Europe and North America. And his latest book is The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Galeotti.
Good to be here.
Well, thank you, Mark. And what did you make of this press conference that followed the meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, a meeting, of course, that was closed, not even note takers? So this was the only opportunity the world got to see these leaders set side by side. And let me just fill you in on a couple of the quotes from former top intelligence officials here. The former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan, called the president's performance nothing short of treasonous. He said, Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous. Not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, he is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you? And then, of course, the former director of National Intelligence, General James Clapper, said it was truly unbelievable. On the world stage, in front of the entire globe, the president of the United States essentially capitulated and seems intimidated by Vladimir Putin. So what were your impressions?
Yes, I must admit, it was an extraordinary, disquieting and depressing experience. Not so much because I felt that Donald Trump was intimidated by Vladimir Putin, but more that, in fact, he seemed so desperate to want to be Putin's friend. And therefore, we had this position in which Trump allows Putin to be the responsible adult, the statesman, and allows Russia to look as if it's a peer power to the United States, while he himself puts on an extraordinarily undignified spectacle in which he gives Russia a pass on issues from election meddling to the invasion of Crimea, while at the same time attacking his own intelligence community. It is very, very difficult to credit as an outsider that this is the leader of the free world.
And how do you think this played in Russia?
Well, I've already been taking a look at the sort of first responses on the Russian media. And, I mean, it is clear that they are jubilant. I mean, in many ways, they're taking their cue from the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, who said that this was better than super. I think they all agree. I mean, very much they play the angle that this demonstrates that if anyone is making their country great again, it's Putin with Russia. And at the same time, I mean, there is some hope that this may lead to improved relations. I think a hope that actually will be dashed. But in the main, absolutely, the Russians are very, very satisfied with what happened.
So do you think that, I know this is more of a question for the American domestic analysis, and you're in Prague, and you study Russia very closely, but do you think it's possible that this could be a turning point in the American electorate? When you have John Brennan in his really outspoken criticism of this meeting basically saying Trump is, it was nothing short of treasonous, and it's clear that Trump is wholly in Putin's pocket. Then he goes on to say, Republican patriots, where are you? Is it possible that even viewers of Fox News in this country looking at this could see that there was something wrong with this picture, that the president of the United States was not standing up for America, and he seemed to have some peculiar deference to Putin, to the point where it almost looks like, as James Clapper said, Putin appears to be Trump's case officer?
Well, I mean, 2 points, really. And one is in terms of this notion of Putin as Trump's case officer. One thing that we have to say is the Russians do know how to handle intelligence assets. They may not be able to sort of run an economy, but they do know how to run intelligence. And if anything, I would have thought that if the Russians really were writing the script, they probably would have toned it down, because precisely they wouldn't want to burn their asset. They want Trump in the White House longer term. More generally, I think in some ways, really what this emphasizes is that three-party politics has come to the United States. There are the Democrats, there are the Republicans, and then there is Donald Trump. Now, the question is whether enough Republicans would be willing to break with Donald Trump. I mean, we have what we might call the usual suspects, the John McCains and so forth. But are others at this point in the run-up to the midterms? Because however much of a minority, I mean, Trump clearly does have some exceedingly vocal and active supporters. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I think the question is really how long-term the reverberations are for this. Something we have to say is, and this is also, remember, coming on the heels of a trip to NATO and then a trip to the United Kingdom, in which Trump, unlike his treatment of Putin, seemed to want to go out of his way to alienate and anger his allies. But this is all international affairs, which tends not to have great traction. Now, if when he comes back to the States, this just becomes consigned into that basket of old Trump will be Trump, and nothing kind of practical comes out of it, then he might be able to weather it. The question is whether or not it actually reaches a stage where it has, so to say, critical mass sufficient to become a true domestic political issue. So what we're going to have to do is basically see what other Republicans who are, those Republicans who up to now have withheld their criticism of Trump publicly, whether they are now willing to join in this chorus of disdain and disapproval.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Galeotti, who is a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, an expert and prolific author on transnational crime and Russian security affairs. He has also advised the British Foreign Office and many governments and law enforcement agencies in Europe and North America. And his latest book is The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. So the impression, though, that I think, and I watched a lot of our media, like CNN and others, responding to pretty much immediately after the press conference, CNN had their people in Helsinki, as did NBC News and others. And some of them, the anchors, were literally in shock. They said, this is, Anderson Cooper said, this is absolutely a disgraceful display. And I think what was most disturbing was when Trump was asked the question about what did he say to Putin about Russian meddling in the elections, and he simply did not answer it. And he went on and on and on about Hillary Clinton and her service as though she were president somehow, that she won, and he didn't. And it was clearly a sign of the worst kind of distraction, if you will, displacement. I just cannot for the life of me see how it could work. I mean, he's been beating that drum forever and doing it in front of Putin. It just looked absolutely pathetic. How did it strike you?
Interesting thing. Actually, I was quite surprised he did. Putin himself raised the election meddling in his initial address, because he spoke before Trump. And, I mean, obviously he wasn't going to say, yes, of course, we've done it. So he deflected it. He said it was nothing to do with us. He proposed this idea of a sort of a joint commission of the great and the good to try and deal with improved Russian-American relations. But anyway, he had his answer. He actually had a talking point for an issue that he knew was an absolute sort of priority with the American people. And the comparison between that and the way Trump handled it was, again, one of these quite amazing contrasts. Now, look, we know that Putin is an experienced and relatively sophisticated operator on the world scene. So, you know, it's not surprising that Putin is able to outpoint Trump on these matters. But on the other hand, you know, it's always meant to be one of Trump's strengths is his capacity to be a communicator. And on this basis, it's not just simply that it was a bizarre and disrespectful detour around all these old conspiratorial talking points. It's also that it was an incoherent one. And again, I mean, I also had a little look at, for example, not just the British, but also the Italian immediate responses, being half Italian myself. And again, there was this combination of shock at what he said and shock at just how badly he says it. But I think we're still trying to come to terms with the fact that, at least insofar as his public utterances are, Trump seems manifestly incapable of doing the job. So, I mean, I think in this respect, yes, it was extraordinary because It was a response to a very, very important and salient question, one that he ought to have some neat, well-planned response to. But we have to be honest, this is just how Trump is. This is not an aberration. This is the kind of way that Trump responds to almost any important question.
Well, when you get the weight of it all, you got the invasion of Crimea, the low-intensity warfare, even though I think, 10,000 people have been killed in Ukraine, so certainly not low-intensity in terms of those people that have been suffering, and the shoot-down of the Malaysian airliner, the poisoning of the Skripals in Salisbury, and then recently the collateral damage of one British woman dying and her partner being gravely ill from the Novichok. I believe they finally found a container, which was a perfume bottle. Mm-hmm. So all of that's going on, and then you've got the Mueller inquiry, and then only on Friday did 12 GRU, Russian military intelligence officials, get indicted before a U.S. grand jury. So that's the Department of Justice, the government of the United States speaking. Our DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, a Republican senator, he basically said Russia is attacking us in cyberspace and undermining our infrastructure and going after our elections. All of this is happening, and on the other side of the scale, the best that Trump can offer up is Hillary Clinton's server.
Yes, and particularly, again, let's note the fact that at the very time where the American intelligence community, more broadly than just the Mueller inquiry, is pointing the finger, clearly this exceedingly aggressive political and cyber campaign that has been launched by the Russian state. We also have President Trump saying that Russia is a foe, a competitor, but a foe the same way as the European Union and China are foes. In other words, he basically was bracketing Russia with the European Union, which is, after all, America's most solid allies. So it's this extraordinary normalization that we're getting. It's actually, he seems to be going out of his way to both undermine NATO as well as American relations with Europe, at the same time as he's essentially saying, well, look, the Russians don't do anything that we don't do. When he was asked the question about where blame lay for the distinct deterioration in Russian-American relations, he didn't point the finger at election meddling. Even if he wanted to put that to one side, which I don't understand why he would want to, he didn't point the finger at the annexation of Crimea, at this undeclared war in the Donbass, at all kinds of other incidents. Instead, he basically said, well, it's both sides, and then went on to talk about the Mueller inquiry as some kind of terrible exacerbating factor. So, even in this respect, he seemed determined to, shall I say, drag America down even while he's elevating Russia.
Well, Putin himself, of course, did address the question, and I think rather cleverly, he said, yes, we did want Donald Trump to win the elections because he had already made it clear that he wanted to have improved relations with Russia. So it seemed to me that that was, he obviously dodged the real question about collusion, in fact, denied it. And Trump, by the way, said that Putin had very, very strongly denied it, as though that somehow settled the matter.
Well, quite. We can hardly expect Putin to throw up his hands and say, you have got me. Of course, Putin is going to deny whatever. And I think the question is not really, did the Russians interfere? They clearly did. It's the real question is actually how much impact that had and how much, if any, collusion there was. But no, so there is something there. I mean, that is almost impossible, I would suggest, to disagree. It's this question of, okay, one would expect the president of Russia to talk down the Russian role. One would not necessarily expect the president of America to accept those promises at face value. Because we should also remember, for example, to make one very, very specific incident, Putin basically disavowed any presence of Russian troops in Crimea, who, of course, turned out indeed to be Russian troops, just not wearing their little Russian flags on their sleeves. He has existing form that's been perfectly willing to lie in the name of statecraft. But apparently, because he responded very strongly, Well, that makes all the difference. It's hard to see how that logic can apply.
Well, one of the things that Trump said, which again was just breathtaking, he blamed the deterioration in U.S.-Russian relations not on Putin's behavior, but on the Mueller inquiry. And then he made some little aside reference to turning to Putin to say, well, of course, in Russia, you wouldn't put up with that kind of thing. That seemed to me to indicate, or that was a glimpse, I think, of this peculiar affection that Trump has for autocrats and for autocratic rule.
Exactly. I mean, I think that in many ways, we should feel sorry for poor Donald Trump, who ended up being president of a country with a constitution, with a Supreme Court, with all the checks and balances that have been built into the system. What he really wants to be is precisely the autocratic chief executive officer of USA Incorporated. And absolutely, this is a man who basically can't meet an autocrat without feeling not just that he likes them, but that he envies them. And we've seen this in his contact with, particularly, for example, the Chinese, as well as the North Koreans. And it would be easy from time to time to dismiss an individual comment as a joke or a malapropism. But when he has already been heard wishing that the American media were a little bit more like the North Korean media in all their sort of toadying propagandistic fervor, it is absolutely clear that basically this is not a man who feels any particular affection for the limitations of his office, for democracy, for regard for the rule of law, for all the constitutional niceties. And this is why he has his affinity with autocrats and authoritarians.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, turning to your latest book, Mark Gagliardi, The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. As we know, Donald Trump has always been a kind of fake billionaire, and his real wealth has been considerably less than what he's lobbied Forbes magazine to get on their lists with. That's been a real obsession with him. And it would seem to me that the wannabe billionaire met at the Nobu restaurant in Moscow in November of 2013 with about 12 of the top Russian oligarchs. He was hoping that Putin would show up, but Putin wasn't able to go, but he sent his closest deputy. And my understanding is that at that meeting, Trump sort of bought into their worldview, but it perhaps had a lot to do with the fact that this sort of billionaire envy, the fake billionaire, really envies these real billionaires who have absolute power over this country that they've looted. And, of course, they're regulated by Putin, and Putin's wealth has been estimated at between $50 billion and even $200 billion, so God knows how much money he has. So is there an element, do you think, of billionaire envy here with Trump and these Russian oligarchs and Putin?
Billionaire envy, probably yes, but I think more generally, I mean, let's be honest, you become a billionaire in Russia generally not because you're a smart cookie or you have a particularly good idea, but precisely because you have the right political connections. Everything, political influence, contact, or whatever, is there to be monetized. And we see that is central to Trump's own character. I mean, the way that in many ways he's already monetizing his position in the White House, whether it's in terms of talking up his own particular business empire or essentially requiring the American taxpayer to pay for his various jaunts to Trump properties. So one way or the other, I mean, this is a man who believes that the purpose of political power is to make money. And also, it demonstrates the extent to which, although I'm still unconvinced by the notion that in many ways sort of Trump is directly under the Russian state's influence. But nonetheless, I mean, from the first, the Trump organization has been, in my opinion, little more than a pyramid scheme, which desperately constantly needs more money flowing in. And to that end, essentially, we have seen that its approach has been any business is good business. So we have all kinds of various shady deals and shady characters involved, whether it's just simply buying an apartment here or whether it's actually making a major financial commitment there. Not just Russian, but, I mean, people from all kinds of different dodgy jurisdictions. And again, I think this speaks to the fact that, in many ways, Trump is indeed Russian Monte. that, you know, it's a business empire that is built on cronyism, is built on shady deals, is built on questionable money, and now it's being built on leveraging political power. These are all very much the kind of characteristics that we see in Russian business.
Well, Mark Gaglietti, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Gaglietti, who's a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, an expert and prolific author on transnational crime and Russian security affairs. He's also advised the British Foreign Office and many government and law enforcement agencies in Europe and North America. And his latest book is The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how disheartening it is to see our own president reject the findings of our own Justice Department and intelligence agencies to defend Putin and blame everything on Hillary Clinton and her email servers.
Because after all, he's just a man. Something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.
You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Catherine Stoner, Director of International Policy Studies and Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and its Center for Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and her forthcoming book is Russia's Return as a Global Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Stoner.
Thank you.
And if Russia is to return as a global power, that was pretty much on display today. The asymmetry, if you will, between Putin and Trump was palpable. Trump was incoherent and amateurish, and the craven fealty he was displaying towards Putin was deeply troubling. But on the other hand, it would seem to me that Putin was just playing it perfectly from his point of view, both for the global audience and the Russian audience.
Yeah, it was definitely peculiar jarring, really, more than peculiar, to see and hear an American president essentially side with a foreign state and one that happens to be at the moment an adversary of the United States over the U.S. intelligence community. It's just perplexing why that would happen. And it makes one want to know more of any background that we don't know already about this relationship. And hopefully the Mueller investigation will shed some light on that.
Well, I think I have to add, surely, that the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, just said the other day that we are, in fact, under attack by Russia at this moment. So he's siding with somebody that's not just an adversary, but who has attacked us and is continuing to attack us. And that.
Yeah, right. I think that's true. And you know, you're also, if one goes on Twitter, you can see responses from former U.S. ambassadors who've served in Republican and Democratic administrations. I'm thinking of Nick Burns, for example, just absolutely condemning this and expressing dismay and surprise and wanting some accountability for Trump's statements. And John McCain has also tweeted out that this is one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory, and that this has debased the office of the President of the United States. So, you know, even members of his own party, also John Brennan, former director of the CIA, saying something very, very similar. So what to make of it, why this happened, what you know, it does make one think that there is some sort of leverage, perhaps, that President Putin does have over Trump personally. There's very little else to explain this, frankly.
Well, there wasn't any really good explanations for why the meeting took place in the first place.
Yeah.
And frankly, as far as I can tell, the only possible thing that could come out of it would be some kind of deal, which was, you know, hinted at by both Putin and Trump, but particularly Putin, that he's willing to go along with some kind of deal that would guarantee Israel's security vis-a-vis Iran's activities in Syria. And I think the only world leader that came out in praise of this pretty disgraceful display today in Helsinki was Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah.
So what do you know about that, and what do you think might be on the table there?
So not surprising that Netanyahu would like that. I don't think that Russia has tremendous leverage over Iran, and certainly we have zero leverage over Iran, especially since President Trump has gone around tearing up, you know, the agreement that we had with Iran. So why we are credible now in any international agreement, I don't know. He's absolutely destroyed U.S. credibility on that. Russia has good relations with Netanyahu and has built relations with Israel over the years, you know, is pragmatic and strategic. So I'm not sure anything big is ever going to come out of this president, and he's so naive that, you know, he sees great victories in things that are really nothing. North Korea is a great example. Why this summit happened is a big question mark. They evidently went in with zero expectations, zero goals, and what we'll get out of it, I would predict, will be zero, and in fact, worse than that. I think it's been extremely negative for the United States, and just abysmal that the President of the United States would not represent American interests. And I think the real issue in terms of domestic politics here is, what will his own party do? This is not the party of Reagan.
Well, but prior to this sort of non-event, although we're talking about it in terms of dismay, prior to this, of course, real things happened, and they were all dreadful. And mm-hmm. arguably they were kind of misogynistic too, because he beat up on the two women leaders of Germany and the UK, undermined them on their own territory, in effect campaigning against them and promoting their opposition, kept the Queen waiting, offended the Brits by smugly lounging in Winston Churchill's armchair. I could go on. And, of course, basically undermined NATO. So it's not as if he's sort of passive in his amateurism. He actually does real damage.
Yeah, so, right. I mean, this trip has been a disaster all the way around. In terms of American interests, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. You know, the United States has interests that are fixed. And this attempt to destroy NATO is in Russia's interest, not in America's interest. It isn't a transactional one-for-one relationship. You don't pay dues. So this focus on you're not paying what you owe, I mean, that was a declaration made in 2014 to try and hit that 2% mark by a certain time, 2024. And what Trump did wasn't new, and it didn't really make any difference whatsoever. Spending on defense has gone up in some of those countries. And frankly, even if it does, it doesn't mean the United States is going to spend less on its own defense. So, you know, it's absurd. And the way he presents it is more than misleading. It's either he doesn't understand or he's purposely lying, and both are bad from the perspective of the United States to have a leader like that. So I think the big question is, what is anyone going to do about this? What are our other elected leaders going to do about this? This is absurd. This makes me frightened as an American citizen. I don't think we have someone in charge who has our interests at heart.
So the fact that the leader of the opposition, if you will, minority leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, said today that it appears that Putin, quote, holds damaging information over President Trump, Do you think, short of because we, as we know, the attacks on the Justice Department, particularly on the Deputy Attorney General, continue, and I don't know that this performance in Russia is going to deter these Tea Party Republicans from going ahead with their attempts to impeach Rod Rosenstein. They're placing unrealistic demands on him to hand over work product from Mueller's secret investigation, which would immediately be leaked to Fox News, that's clearly designed to put him in a situation where he has to refuse and then gives them the excuse to impeach. And that seems to be something that's probably being coordinated by the White House. So if everybody's counting on Mueller, do you think that at the end of the day, we're going to be told what exactly is this peculiar hold of damaging information over Trump that Chuck Schumer's alluding to?
Yeah, so obviously Chuck Schumer knows presumably more than we do. But my guess is that there's money laundering and that related to Trump's businesses in the 2000s. And then the other, you know, the other question is, you know, some sort of compromising material from his visit in for the Miss Universe pageant. And then the third is really more sort of evidence of coordination with the Russians during the campaign. And it is awfully peculiar that the very day that he says, Russia, if you're listening, where are those 30,000 emails of Hillary Clinton's, that they actually seem to go in and look around at the email. The Russian agents go in and look around for email on the DNC servers. I guess my other big question here for, you know, for Republicans who are the majority in Congress is, what's the difference between going in and stealing this information electronically than going in and during Watergate and stealing it physically from the DNC? I mean, this is, you know, what we'll find, I fear, is that there is, of course, evidence of the Russian agents being directed by Americans attached to the Trump campaign.
Well, and, as it happened, that was Trump's only defense today in the press conference in Helsinki after reporters asked him about the recent indictments by Mueller and the accusations against Putin and Russia. All he could say was Hillary Clinton's email and Hillary Clinton's server. I found that to be the most surreal of all. And I wonder whether that's just that old saw is, you know, or as Bill Clinton would say, whether that dog's going to hunt.
Yeah. Well, that's just whataboutism. and that is just classic, you know, an attempt to deflect. And who cares at this point? She didn't win the election. He did. And he's had 18 months to do something about this, and he's done nothing. And he hasn't protected the United States. And, you know, I really wonder when his own party is going to value the safety and security of American citizens over this president. And he's doing the bidding, clearly, of a foreign actor. And I've seen the word treason trotted out on Twitter many times. I think we have to be cautious with that. But how can we possibly explain this behavior if not for the president of Russia having some sort of hold over the president of the United States?
Well, Catherine Stoner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Stoner, who's Director of International Policy Studies and Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and its Center for Democracy Development and Rule of Law at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and her forthcoming book is Russia's Return as a Global Power. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.